Today I'd like to take a look at something which is a departure from what we normally look at. Normally we begin and spend most of our time in Tanakh, looking at the Parsha, looking at perhaps parallels or echoes of things in the Parsha. Today we're going to focus all of our attention on the Midrash. The starting point is going to be a Midrash that is anchored in this week's Parasha. This week's Parasha is really a transitional one of Avraham to Yitzchak. The first third of the parsha is Avraham and Yitzchak's not mentioned. It's Avraham's purchase of Machpelah. The final part is Avraham and Yishmael's death and burial, and already counting their life. And the middle, which is the main section, is the real transition, which we talked about in the past, about Avraham sending his slave, but the slave ending up with Yitzchak. And just one note to remind you is that when he sends the slave is definitely the slave of Avraham and represents himself in Haran as Eved Avraham. However, when he arrives back, he does not come back to Hebron. He evidently comes back. He does come back to Beersheba. Avraham is nowhere to be seen. Yitzchak is there. And when the girl asks, who is that man, Dahinu Yitzchak, and the slave says, who Adoni? So there has been a transfer of ownership of the slave from Avraham to Yitzchak. However, it's very clear that Avraham is still alive and will be alive for another 35 years at this point, although he may not know it. So there's a transition. At the beginning of the end, meaning the beginning of the last paragraph about Avraham in our text, we hear that Avraham is old, getting along in his years. That's why his last will and testament, or his last deathbed wish, whatever it is to make sure that Yitzchak does not marry a local girl, etc. And subsequent to the successful negotiations and marriage between Yitzchak and Rivka, we go back to Avraham. And we find the following pasuk. By Yosef Avraham, this is, by the way, a great answer to a trivia quiz. Where do you ever find a man and his great-grandson next to each other in a pasuk? By Yosef Avraham. All right, it's just a joke. Okay, by Kach Isha Ushma Keturah. By Yosef Avraham, so Avraham continues or adds on, whatever it is, and he takes a wife, and her name is Keturah. Who is Keturah? The answer is very simple. Keturah is a woman who Avraham marries. All right, Vatela lo et Zimran vet Yokshan, and there's a whole host of children that she has, some of them who are names that you are familiar with, like Midian, from later on, Bedouins, etc. And if you look ahead in Pasuk Hale, in that first selection, Vatena Ramad kol ha-shelo li-Yitzchak. Now, Ishmael's already been dispossessed or has been sent away and disinherited, I guess. And so the text says that Avram gives everything he has to Yitzchak, which stands in apposition to these psukim that tell us about Avram having all of these other kids. Which then leads to this pasuk. V'livneha pilag shim. So, what does pilag shim mean? Yeah, pilag shim is concubines. Who are the concubines? We didn't hear about any concubines. We know about a Shifcha, who is not a concubine, and that is Hagar. We know about Keturah, who is an Isha, and of course we know about Sarah. So, v'livneha pilag shim asher li Avraham, natan Avraham matanot. So, the temptation of how to read this easily would be to say, okay, Avraham married Sarai. That lasted many years. That produced one child. In the meantime, Avraham took Hagar as a wife temporarily. That produced another child, and then she and the child were out. And then, later on in his life, Avraham married another woman and had a bunch of kids. And independently of that, the simple read would be, then he also had some pilag shim and a bunch of kids as part of the fulfillment of a great nation, etc. We never heard about them because we don't care about them, but they're there to be aware of. And what does he do? Natan Avraham matanot. He gives them gifts. Vayishalchem yal Yitzchak beno beno denu chai. He sends them to the east. And we never hear about them again, except we do, maybe. Question is, who are these B'nai Pilagshim? And who are these Pilagshim, more importantly? So if you say these Pilagshim are some other women, which is, the temptation of the simple read of the text, you're left with a huge problem, which is, what happens to Keturah and her kids? In other words, here's Avram, he's got a bunch of kids with Keturah, and then the text says he gives everything he has to Yitzchak, so we've got to account for those kids. And then it says, oh, and Avram took the Pilagshim's kids and sent them away. So the only conclusion you can really draw safely here is to say that even though Keturah is called an Isha, she's also called a Pilegesh. In other words, it's not formal marriage, it's like common law wifery. Okay, but that still leaves us with the problem of Pilag Shim. Right? Why in the plural? And we're going to see about that in the Midrash. Okay. And that takes us back to the question of who Keturah is, and the simple answer is Keturah, some woman that Avram marries later on. Now, important to note, and I didn't have room for it, so I left it off. The Sforno has an interesting comment about these children. He says, if you look in Divrei HaYamim, it's very clear that Avram had two children, Yitzhak and Ishmael, and that's it. And he says, therefore, all of these kids, Batelid Lo, should be understood to be that he raised them. That they were Keturah's kids, and he married Keturah, and then he raised these kids, but they weren't his biological kids. And Sforno says this clearly, based on Divrei HaYamim. Now, it depends how much you read Divrei HaYamim into Bereishit, as to how you're going to accept it, because the simple read of Atela, though, is that she had kids with him. But the way that they're reading it is that. Now, if we read it that way, that might put us on safer ground. Because then you could say, well, he raised them, and he took care of them, but that doesn't mean he owes them anything as an inheritance, and that might explain the difficulty in the text. Nonetheless, Chazal do something... Well, Chazal, in some voices, do something which we are all very familiar with. So familiar with that if you ask the average kid on the street right now, come up to him and say, who is Keturah? The kid will come up to you and say, what's a Keturah? But if you ask the average kid in one of our day schools, who is Keturah? Without batting an eyelash, what will they say? Hagar. Why will they say that? Because they know the Rashi. Rashi in Bereshit here, exactly on this Pasuk, Chafei Pasuk Aleph, says, Keturah zu Hagar. And what does it mean, Keturah zu Hagar? It means that this woman is really Hagar, and she's got another name, a new name, a different name. She's called Hagar, but she's called Keturah. But she's Hagar, same woman. That's what that means. Okay? V'nikreit Keturah. So why is she called Keturah? Al shem shenaim ma'aseha kiktoret. Her actions are beautiful and sweet, like the sweet-smelling ktoret. Keturah. Okay? This is now a play on the root kuf tet resh in Aramaic, which means to tie, as in a knot. She sort of tied a knot protecting her chastity from the time she left Avraham until she came back to him. So for all those years that she was gone, she didn't have relations with any other man because she wanted to keep herself for Avraham. Somehow she'd be coming back. So she's called Keturah. Which means what? Which means that the real name on her birth certificate is Hagar. And that she gets a nickname, Keturah, because of two very nice things about her. So we call her Keturah. Now, this midrash is very difficult for an obvious reason. And that is that the text knows how to tell us when two names are the same person. The text knows how to tell us when two different names are the same person, such as Avram hu Avraham in Nehemiah. Or more famously, perhaps, Hadassah hi Esther, where the text tells us, here's a girl, she's got one name, she's got another name. Or Daniel hu Belshazzar. Or Vayikra Yosef Parop Shem Yosef Tzafnat Paneach. So we know, if we meet Tzafnat Paneach, we know his name's Yosef. Or Vayikra Moshe Lehoshea Minun Yehoshua. So we're told, this guy is known by two names. There's his birth name and his given name. There is title name and his personal name. There is his earlier name and his later name. His divinely given name, whatever it might be, and we're told about that. We are not told in any book of Tanakh that says Hagar hi Keturah.
But do you have names where they're not told?
What?
You have in Tanakh also where you have two names, but they don't say that.
You know, Yitro has a bunch of names.
Yitro has different names.
Not really. We talked about that. And that's exactly the argument that I gave for saying that Reuel is one person, Yitro's his son, and Chobab's another son. Now, the fact that Yitro is also called Yeter is not a big deal. Because you find Yechonyahu and Konyahu and Yehoyachin is all the same guy, and Yirmiyah and Yirmiyahu. That's not unusual. Yonatan, Yehonatan, those are just variations. John and Johnny. That's still the same person. But to have two radically different names that are not versions of each other, and to say, yeah, this is really the same person, is difficult unless the text tells us, in which case, then we know the person was, like in the case of Moshe, in the case of Hoshea, Yehoshua, he was given that name by Moshe, we hear about it. Right? Okay, so I have to figure out what's going on in this text. There's a few other things to think about when we see this. First of all, Rashi And it's not Rashi, it's the Midrash, but Rashi quoting this Midrash and adopting the Midrash, and you're going to see that Rashi here is, if you will, making a decision about what part of the Midrash to take, because the Midrash is not univocal on this issue, or on any of these issues. And Rashi is picking a position and saying, Hagar zu k'turah zu Hagar. He runs into a big problem because now how many women did Avram ever have relations with in this story? Two, Sarai and Hagar. Sarai is definitely never called a Pilegah. She's a full wife. Which means that how many Pilegshim do we have in Avram's life? One. All right, so take a look. What does Rashi do with Pilegshim? Next, Rashi, three. Chaser k'tiv. I'm not sure because in all the texts I could find, it's Pilegshim with a yod. But say chaser k'tiv, which means that it's written without a yod. Pilag sham. And it's without a yod, makes it not necessarily plural. All right, and therefore, who is this Pilegesh? The single Pilegesh now is Hagar. And now, who are the Bnei Pilegshim? Yishmael plus that list are all Bnei Hagar. And Avram gives them gifts and sends them away. Or you could say Yishmael was not part of this group, but he's still Ben Hagar. Okay. Comes along the Rashbam, and you're not surprised at all because you know the Rashbam well enough to expect this. In passage 5, what does the Rashbam say in HaPilagshim? Hagar uktura. Why does he say that? Because the Rashbam elsewhere says that the pshat of who the Rashbam in source 4 says, k'tura l'fi pshat ein zu Hagar. In other words, the simple read of this, which means the original intent, or if I want to go even more radically conservative, try that one, is that what really happened is there are two different women, one named Hagar, one named Tura, and that's what happened. And Avram married or took Hagar and had Yishmael, and she's gone and never sees her again. And then later in life, this Tura shows up and has kids with her or adopts her kids. Parenthetically, there's a side note we have to remember here. A side note. What is the typical range of age-bearing years for women? Just biologically. 12 to 40s, right? 40s. Beyond that, in our day with the drugs, etc., we hear about more, but in beyond that, typically we think about it as something out of the ordinary and quite unusual and perhaps even miraculous. This, by the way, is the Ibn Ezra's claim, we've talked about it in the past, about the issue of Yocheved. You know, Yocheved is presented in some Midrashim as having been born at the entrance of Mitzrayim, as they came in. And that she's the missing 70th. Because you remember, in Vayigash, we count, these are Bnei Israel, and you count them, and you come up with 69. But it says there's 70. So how are there 70? So one of the answers is that Yatz Yocheved, who was born as they came in. So she's not counted, but she was already there as they came in. The problem Ibn Ezra raises is, if that's the case, Bnei Israel were there 210 years. And Moshe was 80 when they left, which means Moshe, when he was born, his mom was 130. And Ibn Ezra's problem is, not that that's impossible, because so is 90, but he says, if you're going to make a huge deal out of Sarah at 90, shouldn't you make a huge deal out of 130? That's his claim. So you would think that if somebody's having kids at a super advanced age, okay, so now, how old was Avram when Yishmael was born? The text tells us, 86. Okay, how old is he now? He's at least 137 because Sarah died already at 127, and he's 10 years older. So he's over 137 at this point. All right? So the fact that he can go on having kids, okay, but who's having kids with? You see the problem. If it's Hagar, that means Hagar is in her 60s or 70s at least now, and having not one, but 12, or however many there are here, makes it difficult. So for several reasons, the simplest read of this is Keturah is a different person. It's not Hagar. First of all, because the text would say Hagar, or say Keturah Zu Hagar. And second of all, the timing is just very bizarre. The chronology becomes very weird. So the Rashbam says the pshat is that it's Hagar. That's not Hagar, that's Keturah as a separate woman. And it fits everything. Suddenly Pilag Shim is Pilag Shim. And it could be Hagar and Keturah, that's the Rashbam. Suddenly the years aren't a problem. Suddenly the naming isn't a problem. And that turns the spotlight on the Midrash that says that Hagar is a Keturah Zu Hagar. Where are you coming from and why are you doing this? Which is really my interest here. What's the motivation of the Midrash to identify two disparate people as being the same? Which we've discussed at length in a whole other context about Mumuchan and Haman, which I'll briefly mention as we go along. Now take a look at the Midrash, which is where this is all coming from. Passage 6. Ushmak Turah. Right? Rabbi Yehuda Omar Zu Hagar. Rabbi Yehuda says, who's Turah Zu Hagar? Amar Le Rabbi Nechemia. So Rabbi Nechemia is opposed to this. Not on our grounds, but on different grounds. Vahakti Vayosef. How does the Pasuk start? Vayosef Abraham, which means he added on. Right? And if it's his old wife who he's taking back, you wouldn't say Vayosef. Amar Le Al Pia Dibur Nesa. Okay, so it says that God told him that he should marry her, which also doesn't explain Vayosef. And then, Hey Achman Da'amar, Vayosef Hashem Daber Elai Od. Alright, so this is now Moshe. But the word Vayosef now becomes sort of a nickname, a way of saying Hashem told me to do it. So therefore, Vayosef Avram doesn't mean he added on another wife, but rather Hashem told him to do it. Alright? Amar Le V'Aktiv Ashmak Turah, and now he comes with our problem. But Nechemia says, wait a second, it says her name is Turah. A little different than Rashi. She is surrounded and sort of bejeweled by mitzvot and masim tovim. Avraham is recorded in Pasuk Vav as having pilag shim in the plural. Amalei pilag shamktiv. It's without a yod. That's all Rashi, you see, is dipping into this midrash and getting pieces of it. Okay, good. And then it says that he sends him. You see in pasuk vav, he sends them be'odenu chai. What does be'odenu chai mean? So it's an allusion to be'er lachai roi, the famous be'er that Hagar discovered, the malach shor Hagar, bringing Hagar into the picture again. Okay, the midrash Tanchuma goes a little further with this. And again, my interest in this whole thing is what's the midrash's motivation for sort of forcing this identification, which on the face of it seems impossible. Remember, this story of Avram marrying Keturah appears immediately after the successful marriage of Yitzchak and Rivka, meaning the meeting and the first party. Where is Yitzchak when Rivka comes? Rivka comes on the camels, and Yitzchak is coming from Be'er Lachai Ro'i. What's Be'er Lachai Ro'i? It's a family shrine outside of Be'er Sheva, where Hagar had her interaction with the Malach, and evidently Yitzchak goes there to pray or to meditate or something. Okay, so now, it's a beautiful midrash. Yitzchak married Rivka and turns around and says, you know what, my father's lonely. My mom died 3 years ago, right? 40, 37. My mom died 3 years ago. Abba's lonely. Let's get him a wife. So what happened? He Hagar, he Keturah. So who's that wife? Hagar. Where would he find Hagar? At Be'er Lachai Ro'i. So as Yitzchak, he goes to Be'er Lachai Ro'i to find Hagar, who's sitting there praying or whatever, and brings her back to Avram. Of course, again, the problem is that based just on this, she's about 60, which kind of makes that whole list of kids, you know, kind of difficult. Divrei Rebbe. That's Rebbe. Rebbe says, so now we have two opinions, Rebbe Yehuda and Rebbe, saying that Keturah is really Hagar. Rabotenu Omrim Isha Acheret Natal. What do the rest of the Chachamim say? No, it's another woman. Mata Moshe Rebbe. So why does Rebbe say that? He Hagar Hik Turah. She Yitzchak Bam Bolechari Otasha Kativ Bal Ken Karala Berachai Lori. In other words, Rebbe says that there's a connection between the place Yitzchak was and the new wife that Avram takes, which means it's Hagar. And Rabotenu say, no, her name is Keturah. She's a different woman. Okay, so the general question that I really want to address is not about Keturah and Hagar, but it's a piece of the puzzle. We find so much of this in Chazal, and I broke it down into five categories, but the truth is there are really more categories. One of them is what we're calling cross-identification. Cross-identification is where you have two different people, and we say they're the same person. A couple examples. Yiscah. Who's Yiscah? Now, Yiscah is an interesting problem because when we are introduced to Avram's family, we're told that Avram, that Nahor marries Milcah. Who's Milcah? Bat Haran. Who's Haran? And this sounds funny, the father of Milcah. And I could go on forever. But it says, Avi Milcah v'Avi Yiscah. Now I want you to think about it. When is a parent ever identified as being the father of? When is a person ever identified as being the father of? When his children are famous. When his children are famous. Remember, was it Lillian Carter? Was it? You know, the Oso Aisha's mother. She was, what, 90 when he was in office? The president's mother. That's what she was called, the president's mother. Because that's the Yichus, right? So in the meantime, Haran is made famous through his two daughters, Milcah and Yiscah. So we would expect to hear about Yiscah who fights wars, or Yiscah who's so wise, or Yiscah who's so righteous. In the meantime, we never hear about Yiscah again. Next to it, we are suddenly introduced that Avram, who we're far more concerned with in the text than Nahor, marries a woman named Sarah. We're not told anything about her. What do Chazal say? Yiscah zu Sarah. That's a very famous midrash. Who is Malki Tzedek? Malki Tzedek, the Kohen and the Melech that Avraham meets, and he blesses him after the war with the kings. Malki Tzedek, Chazal say, is Shem. Who's Shem? Noach's son. Shem, right? Chazal say, Malki Tzedek is Shem. Here's another one. Who does Elazar marry? Elazar, the Kohen Gadol after Aharon. Elazar ben Aharon. Who does he marry? He says he takes, the text in Vayera says he takes me benot Putiel. So what's the pshat in that pasuk? What? No, benot Putiel. What's the pshat in that pasuk? There's some guy named Putiel, and he's got daughters, and Elazar married one of the daughters. The Midrash says, no, who's benot Putiel? Daughters of Yosef. Why is Yosef called Putiel? Because Yosef gets a nickname Putiel. Because Pepe Yitzro, he quieted down his Yitzhar, and the scene that makes Yosef most famous in religious history is Mrs. Potiphar. And the second one is Putiel is a reference to Yitro. Because Yitro, Pitem Agalim, he fattened up oxen to bring them to Avodah Zarah, and then he ended up joining us, or joining our belief. And so Putiel now becomes two families, Yosef's family and Yitro's family, and somehow they intermarried, and then a daughter from that was married to Elazar, which is great Yichus. It's very weird. How did Putiel become Yosef and Yitro? It's a very strange thing. If you have the most fun of this in Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim, in the first nine chapters, are all Yichusim, all genealogy of many of the tribes. And a lot of Levi and Yehuda in there. And there's all sorts of names in there that we never heard of. Never heard of elsewhere. And what Chazal do with those names is in many cases they identify them as being really a different character that we know of in Chumash, but have a different name here. And a classic example, so many examples, is Ephrat. Kalev marries Ephrat. Now who's Kalev? It doesn't seem to be the same Kalev as we have in Chumash. It's a later Kalev. He's Kalev ben Chetzron. Our Kalev is Kalev ben Yefuneh. But Kalev marries Ephrat. Who's Ephrat? Ephrat is really Miriam. Why is she called Ephrat? Now listen to the phrasing. Why is she called Ephrat? Sheparuv Ravu Yisrael al Yada. Because through her agency, Am Yisrael increased. What's that referring to? The other midrash, that Miriam was one of the two midwives who, instead of killing the babies, assisted. Right? Because there goes to another one, which I didn't put on here, which is who are Shifra and Pua? Shifra and Pua are either Yocheved and Miriam or Yocheved and Elishava, a less well-known midrash, Ishava Vita or Ishava Kalata. Right? So now, Baruch Shalom, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, I don't get it. Doesn't the author of Divrei Hayamim know the name Miriam? Why can't he just put Miriam? Why does he have to call her Ephrat? And confuse us. And notice what they do in every one of these cases. It's not to say Ephrat zu Miriam, right? And, you know, go home, have fun. Now you know that Ephrat is Miriam. They say Ephrat zu Miriam, v'lamani kashma Ephrat. They did that with Keturah, right? Which means they're starting with an assumption. She has a real name, which is a birth name on the birth certificate, and she has a nickname that she earned because of something she did, and that nickname she's also called by, and the text doesn't bother to identify as being the same person. So Hagar is Hagar, but she does such beautiful things that adorn her like mitzvot, that keep her tied up, that smell sweet like the incense, so she gets called Turah. Miriam is Miriam. But because Am Yisrael increased and multiplied in her because of her agency, therefore she's also called Ephrat. And it goes on and on. Why is Sarah called Yiscah? Her real name is Sarah in the Midrash. She's called Yiscah because Shakol Sochin Biofia. Lischot there means to gaze. Everybody's gazing at her beauty. And the other one is Shaita Socha Beruach HaKodesh. She would gaze Beruach HaKodesh and know that Yishmael didn't belong in the house, etc., etc., and you know her nevuah was great. So in each case we say there's a real name, and then there's a nickname. And the nickname is given because of X, Y, and Z, but of course in Pshat, consistently, we have to say these are different people, because the text knows how to tell us. So again, my question is, why is the Midrash motivated so often to do this and take characters and draw them together? Now, it's not just drawing them together. If you look at the back page, you will see that in the Midrash, there's another phenomenon.
A question.
Yeah.
So is the Keturah is Hagar, this is an exception to the nickname thing, and that you these are probably two different people, whereas the other illustrations you're giving are
no, they're probably all different people.
They're probably all different
people. Yeah, Miriam and Ephrat are different people, because the text knows how to call her Miriam. Right? Yiscah and Sarah may be a different case, because there seems to be a real problem in Pshat there, but nonetheless, the text knows how to tell us that somebody has two names, and if it doesn't, we assume it's somebody else. The question is, why is the Midrash so interested in doing this so much? But it's not just in identifying different names as being the same person. There's also something else the Midrash engages in, and that is the Midrash creates relationships between people who in the text have nothing to do with each other. I'll give you an example. Who's Tamar, the first Tamar? Tamar is the heroine of the Yehuda story. When she gets pregnant, and she's about to be killed because she's a Yavama who has violated the family internal rules, and she's the one who then says, whoever these things belong to is the father, and Yehuda says, it's me, and Hashamnu, and she's saved. The Midrash insists that Tamar, take a look in source 13, Ephraim Mikshat Tamidos Rameir, Amar Mishum Rameir, Tamar Bito Shel Shem Haita. Who was Tamar? Shame's daughter, which, by the way, makes her whose daughter now? Keep all the lines up, Malki Tzedek's daughter. Right? Why is that important? Because if Shame is Malki Tzedek, what's Malki Tzedek? What does the text tell us? Malki Tzedek, what position does he hold? He's a Kohen. What's the rule in the Torah of a Bat Kohen, and only a Bat Kohen, who commits adultery? Sreifa. What is going to happen to Tamar? She's going to get Sreifa. If it turns out she's innocent, she doesn't get it. So you understand how all the links work. Tamar is the daughter of Shem, which is why Sreifa is the proper thing, which means Yehuda is actually paskin incorrectly, until we figure out that she's really innocent. Okay? Two characters that never meet in Tanakh. We're never told about them ever being in the same room. And have a lot to do with each other in the Midrash is Avraham and Nimrod. Right? Nimrod is mentioned in a few psukim in the aftermath of the tower. Actually, before the tower, in the lineage before the tower. And he's a hero, I mean, a valiant fighter, and he's a king, and he's a gibor, etc. And he's a great archer. And then we hear about Avram. And the Midrash, the two of them put together, and Nimrod's the one who throws Avram in the fire, and Nimrod is the one who built the tower, and Avram's opposed to him. All of this, interesting relationships. Just one other one, just stam. Who's Noach's wife? The answer is Mrs. Noach. That's all we know. However, Chazal tell us she's got a name. What's her name? Na'ama. Where'd they get up with Na'ama? Again, Na'ama is a daughter of Lamech. If you remember, Lamech has two wives, and he has three sons, Yaval, Yuval, and Tuval Kain, who are all heads of, you know, the first guys to ever do shepherding, first guys to do the music, and the first guy to be a blacksmith. V'achot Tuval Kain Na'ama. Right? We never hear about Na'ama again. In the meantime, we got Noach and his family, including his wife, who we never hear a name. Chazal put them together and say, oh, his wife is Na'ama. Why is she Na'ama again? Because Na'imim, here it is, Shaita Ma'aseha Na'imim. Her actions were very nice. Right, we don't find her drunk in the tent. Okay. There's yet another phenomenon the Midrash is engaged in. And I'm bringing these all because they have one common thread, which is the Midrash is adding links into the text that aren't there in the text. We've had so far two different people being told they're the same person. Mumuchan Zehaman, Ruel Chavav Yitro, all same person, etc. Then we've had relationships created in the Midrash. Then we've got a third phenomenon. Anonymous people in the Torah, anonymous people in the text, are given names. Who's a famous anonymous person? It's a little unfair. Who's the most famous anonymous person in history?
One who went up to Yosef?
Nope. Most famous anonymous person in history. I promise you, the most famous.
He's anonymous.
I know. What's his name?
How can he have a name?
Plony Almoni. Plony Almoni. The guy in Ruth who is called John Doe. And his name is not there. Plony Almoni. Please take a look at source 17. We're bothered. Boaz says to Plony Almoni, hey, Plony Almoni, sit down. And he does. and the whole case. So what does the Midrash here say? Shimon Levi Amar, Poni Valmoni, Hayashmo, that was his name. In other words, instead of his name being, his name really was John Doe. Yeah, sure. Okay? Meaning, it's like, you know, sign on the hotel, right? John Smith.
How do you spell that? Was it D-O-E or D-O-G-A?
Right? And then, however, there's a different voice. And this, by the way, should remind us of the many Midrashim about the name of Moshe, which we don't know. Moshe is the most famous and the most important anonymous person, in a sense that we don't know his real name. Right? Maybe. Okay? And so we have Imigalech Tov. What does Boaz say to Ruth in the middle of the night? If he redeems you, fine. If not, I'll redeem you. What do they say? Oh, Shayalo Ach Kadom Menu Shishmo Tov. Right? Now, clearly the text wants to say we're not telling you the name. And we do this very famously in Source 21. Source 21 is a great example of this. Rabbi Akiva turns around and says, you know that guy in Parsh Sefer Bamidbar, in Parshat Shlach, who is caught being Mechalal Shabbat publicly and they kill him? You know who it is? It's Slofchad, and I'll prove it to you. All right. And what does Rabbi Yehuda say back to him? Notice, because this really cuts to the heart of what we're doing here. He says, Akiva, either way you're in trouble. Because either the Torah wanted to keep him anonymous, and now you are revealing what the Torah wanted to keep quiet. Or else you're wrong, in which case you are slandering a good guy. Saying he was Mechalal Shabbat when he wasn't. But you understand that this cuts to the heart of this, and I believe the fact that it's Rabbi Akiva here is significant. There are several other things. I want to get to the Nikudai here. There are several other things the Midrash does in the same way, such as giving several different places that have different names and identifying them being the same name, famously with Sinai, different names for Har Sinai, and that they are all named for the significance of the event of Mamad Har Sinai, Mamad Torah. Right? That's really Har Sinai. But it's called Chorev because it destroyed the nations. Or it's really called Chorev, but we call it Sinai because Sinah came the other way. All sorts of other drashot. Right? We even do it with certain objects. So for instance, in Sefer Yoshua, and we studied this many years ago, in Sefer Yoshua, there is a mention of Yoshua's song being in Sefer HaYashar. Haloi Tuval Sefer HaYashar. So the Ibn Ezra, consistently through any of these instances, says, yeah, there was a book called Sefer HaYashar, we don't have it anymore. Famously, the Ibn Ezra in Bamidbar Chafalov says, what's Sefer Milchamot Hashem, that's mentioned in the Torah? It's a book they kept of the record of all the wars, and we don't have it anymore. The Gemara says, what's Sefer HaYashar? Sefer Bereshit. Why is it called Sefer HaYashar? Because the book of the straight people, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Tamot Nafshi Mot Yisharim. Okay. So we have all sorts of these phenomena. I want to focus really on the first four, which is on people. Either identifying two different people as being the same person, identifying relationships, really three things, identifying relationships between people, and identifying anonymous people.
Can you expand on 19, Yosef?
Yeah, so as an example, the text says, when Yosef is sitting there and the brothers are talking among themselves, Yosef starts weeping. And his actions seem a little strange to the brothers, because as far as they know, they're talking Kanani or Hebrew, right? So, Heim lo yadu ki shema Yosef ki amelitz benotam. Yosef had set up a translator between them, so Yosef would speak Egyptian, the translator would speak in Hebrew, and vice versa, and therefore, they thought he didn't understand Hebrew, so they didn't, you know, it's unclear. That's why he had to turn away to cry, so that they wouldn't see what's going on. It says amelitz, a translator. The simple explanation of that is some Egyptian guy who also knew Kanani was brought into the court. The Midrash says Menashe. And that's not the issue. The issue is they're identifying an anonymous person. But the critical thing is that all of these anonymous people are anonymous for a reason.
So Menashe was and
almost
Jew
every
who spoke
Menashe was Yosef's son.
Yeah.
So all of these people who are being identified here are anonymous for a good reason. In most cases, they're just not that important. They're there to move the story along. You mentioned Jason, the guy who Yosef meets, who tells him where the brothers are. He's just there to move Yosef along. He's not important in and of himself. Most of these, Eshet Noach is not that important who she is. But the Midrash does what it does. And I believe that all of these things have one common motivation. What is the agenda of the Midrash? The answer is there are a number of agendas. But one of the, what I believe to be, overriding agendas of the Midrash meaning that literature that flourished really beginning at the end of the biblical period, but its height of flourishing was in Eretz Yisrael in the first 5-6 centuries of the Common Era, a rabbi would get up in the Beit Knesset and give a drasha, right, on something related to what they're going to be reading. A major part, and perhaps the override, the most significant agenda and motivation of the Midrash, is to make the characters, to a lesser event, to a lesser extent, the events, and to a lesser extent, but not insignificant, the locations of Tanakh come alive. Avraham is not a flat personality who lived and died. Avraham continues to live. Yitzchak is not a flat character. Yitzchak continues to live. Now, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov is easy. They're part of our liturgy. They're part of the Brit. That's easy. What about the whole constellation of characters? So what happens is that the Midrash brings it alive through several vehicles. One vehicle is making it, if you will, contemporary. Speaking about Esav like a Roman centurion that they're familiar with brings Esav alive, as opposed to describing Esav in anthropologically correct but not very interesting terms to whatever existed in the year 1500 in Beersheba, 1500 BCE. It's far more interesting to hear about Esav dressed up with the whole armor and everything else and being a gladiator the way the Chazal describe him. It makes Esav very much alive. A crazy example, Josephus. He does the same thing in the Antiquities. When he talks about Avram going down to Egypt, why did Avram go down to Egypt? Because there was a famine. But in Josephus, he adds the following: I'll go down to Egypt because, first of all, we need food, and second of all, I will converse and discuss with the Egyptian priests. And if I can convince them, this is a chutzpahic statement, if you think about it. If I can convince them about the correctness of my view, they will all convert and accept it. And if they can convince me of the correctness of their view, I'll adopt their view. Now, Josephus is describing Avraham like somebody in the streets of Athens right now in the first century, to whom theology is an open discussion. But that's certainly not accurate to who Avraham was. But that's not what Josephus is interested in. That's what the Midrash is interested in. That's not what we're interested in doing in studying Tanakh. We're interested in bringing the characters alive. Now, you think about this. You've got the central characters in a story, and then you've got all these side characters. But they're not insignificant, because otherwise they wouldn't be there. Hagar is not insignificant. Keturah is less significant, but she's not insignificant, otherwise she wouldn't be mentioned. Which is easier for you to do? To grab onto all sorts of tiny characters that you know very little about, or one character that you have a composite picture? So instead of there being a heroine, and by the way, in fact, she's a heroine, Hagar, a tragic heroine. Instead of having Hagar, who's a slave girl, who suffered terribly, and ended up getting sent out of the house, and still was part of the family of Abraham and had this big nation, and you don't think about her. And instead of having Keturah, who's some woman who we don't know much about, but who evidently seems to be special because Avram marries her in her old age and has all these kids with her. Instead, we put them together and we've got a more complete package. Ah, you're going to turn around and say, yeah, but that's not what it was. And that's why Reb Nechemiah says, Isha Acheret Lakach. He said, yeah, Isha Acheret Lakach, that's fine. But for our purpose of what we're trying to do, we want you to get a particular picture. Because we want you to understand, to see what the text is teaching you in the longer range. It's not a history book. If it was a history book, then it would tell you who this person is, who that person is, and leave them alone. Who Avraham is, who Yitzchak is, who Moshe is, who Yirmiyahu is, these are the central big characters of Tanakh. David, of course. And we have a full picture on them. But for so many of the other characters who are on the side, it's critical to weave them together into more complete characters. What? It is to us, because we read history. When we open a history book, we expect the history to be documentable and documented and verifiable. That's not how the Midrash thinks. You know, just one simple example, but we've seen so many here together. In the Midrash, talks about Haman complaining to Ahasuerus about the Jews. And what are his complaints? Just a short version of it. One of his complaints is the Jews aren't keeping Saturnalia. Now, you want to explain to me why a Persian minister in the 5th century BCE is complaining to the Persian king that the Jews aren't keeping a Greek holiday? The answer is because that Midrash was not from the time of Haman. The Midrash was from the time that the Jews were under Roman rule, and part of the claim the Romans had against us was we weren't playing with everybody else and celebrating their holidays. In other words, the Midrash puts into the hero and the villain's mouth what is now being said about, you know, about whatever thing may be going on. That's why, again, Esav is described, Haman is described, all these villains are described really in terms of the Midrash, in terms that are part of the contemporary scene, which makes the figures come alive that much more. Now, is there something dangerous about this? I don't think at all. I don't think there's anything dangerous about this approach to Midrash. And if you look at the Midrashim carefully, you can see that Chazal themselves are battling about this. There wasn't like one person, oh yeah, Hagar Zuk Torah. Not at all. No, it's not Torah is not Hagar Torah, separate people. And the Rashbam says that's Pshat. Now notice what the Rashbam says carefully. We'll end with this. The Rashbam in source 4 says Torah, Lefi HaPshat Ein Zu Hagar. Why does he have those words? Lefi HaPshat. What? Because he's not trying to negate the Midrash. To know the Rashbam understands that the Rashbam has tremendous respect for the Midrash, love for the Midrash, and thinks that the Midrash is the Ikar. He says that in his famous comment in Vayeshev. The Rashbam's agenda, as he states it, is that because we've spent so much time with the Midrash, we've forgotten how to see Pshat. So that's my job, to restore Pshat. But he says the main thing is the lessons you get out of it. Think about it when you read a legal text. You read a legal text, the most of the halakha you practice is not read straight out of the legal text. That's fundamentalist. We operate based on Midrash. But it's important to be able to also read the story straight. So what do? We try to kind of balance both and say, let's read the story, see what the story says. Here's a new woman who's named Keturah. Now, there's a Midrash that says Keturah Zuhagar, and let's figure out what the Midrash is trying to express, teach, and pull out of the text by making that connection, which is not pshat. I don't think Rashi would disagree with his grandson and say, no, if you have Shad Zu Hagar, I think he'd agree, it's not Hagar. But the Midrash is telling us something very different. And to get a picture of Hagar, who when we first meet her, we're not so sympathetic to her, and suddenly see her as somebody who's been loyal to Avraham the whole time, who comes back to the tent of Avraham years later after not agreeing to be with any other man in the whole time, and that she is a beautiful, adorned woman with all these great ma'asim, in spite of being thrown out of the house. It's a very powerful statement. And that's somebody that maybe you can learn something from, or be inspired by her in some cases, for some people maybe identify with. And so much of that really operates within the scheme of things. Now, Tamar being made as the daughter of Shem, and then Shem being Malki Tzedek, and all of that weaved together, serves perhaps another purpose, which is there's a Midrashic agenda, which we find coursing through the Midrashim, of Torah being practiced before Matan Torah. And such as that, when did the three visitors come to Avraham? They must have come on Pesach, because what did Avraham make for them? Matzot. Right? And that leads to the idea that Yitzchak was born on Pesach, because a year from now, the baby will be born. Right? And so there's a lot of that coursing through the Midrash also, which is part of another picture of the Torah being kind of built into the world and being there from the beginning, and even before the beginning. But that's perhaps part of another shiur. What I wanted to really focus on, which is something that sort of starts in our Parsha, is this Midrashic... it's not a tendency, it's far more than that, this Midrashic style of identifying different characters as being one, bringing different characters into relationship that doesn't exist otherwise, and identifying anonymous characters. I think it's all driven by the same agenda, to try to create a more composite picture of who we're dealing with, and to give us a little bit more inspirationally and worldview-wise something to link on to.